We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and I'm here with John Clark, telecom professor at the University of Kentucky. Hello again, John.
Hi, Andy.
Once again, it's great to have you here in Fairfax with us, finally, after all these phone conversations we've had on the air.
Thanks very much. I love being here, except for any time I encounter that beltway.
Yeah, well, that is different than Lexington's beltway.
It certainly is.
Anyway, we're talking about the Do Not Call list, and moving on to the Do Not Resuscitate list, I think it's called.
It's too early for me to think about that, please.
No, the Do Not Track list. So This is a web initiative. If you like the Do Not Call list, folks, where people cannot call you with commercial messages, you will love the Do Not Track list if you're worried about tracking. Now, last segment, we talked about the issue of tracking. A lot of people don't worry about it, but we would argue that you should. If you're out there and you care about privacy, this is a slippery slope, and they are the thing about digital technology, and this goes back to a concept that, was it Shoshana Zuboff in her book, or was it the other lady's book? She talked about what computer technology does. The Industrial Revolution gave us automation, and so we had machines that could automate processes. But computers not only automate things, they give us information as well as automation. And information is the ability to keep track of everything that's been automated and everything it does, and it records it and tracks it. So that previous conversation in the last segment was essentially about that topic, that anything you do online in a digital computer and in a digital internet, the digital internet, anything you do can be tracked and monitored and put in a database. Somebody can figure out what it is and use that information in some way to serve you better, as we say, to show you ads, to do any number of things. But they're watching us, folks.
They are watching us, and as you said, most people either are unaware of it or just don't care. But my position is you wise up. You need to know what's involved and what the dangers are.
Yeah, so the Do Not Track registry, which would be essentially the ability for a consumer to say, I don't want to be tracked by all these companies. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little background on how that might work? And then we'll get into some of the pitfalls or the reason why this is much more difficult to engineer than the Do Not Call list.
Well, this technology has been in place for so long that it's an absolutely integral part of web server software. That's just the way the software has been made for quite a while. As you're probably aware, and many of your listeners are aware, there's an operating system that underlies how your computer works and interacts with its own hardware. There's an operating system for a web server, too. It's server software. And that's just a routine component of server software, is the ability to track where you come from and where you go and what you do while you're on the website. So it's a given. That's the way all server software is made nowadays, and you can choose to use that component or not. So the deal would be in enacting a Do Not Track law. Essentially, what would have to happen is that those components of the server software would have to be eliminated or rendered inoperable. And similarly, all web browsers would have to include the technology that would keep you from being from tracked, because that's the way browsers work. They interact with the server software for the websites you're visiting.
Well, in fact, it's worth it. An Apple user like yourself will enjoy this, but it's worth taking a cheap shot at Bill Gates and Microsoft here, because I have stopped using Internet Explorer entirely. I use Mozilla's Firefox.
As do I.
And one reason is that Bill Gates and Microsoft set up Internet Explorer, their web browser, to maximize the ability of websites to put hooks into Internet Explorer that made it really easy for them to pass information to your computer and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons why you have more problems with Internet Explorer and you get more viruses and you get more all kinds of problems is that he made it too easy. His idea was this open communication between the PC, the desktop computer, and the servers, between advertisers and consumers, from which Microsoft would make money in a variety of ways.
Exactly. And one of the things we've seen in the last couple of years is this war heat up between Microsoft and Google for, they're both interested in domination. So the two of them have been going head to head over who can develop the best interface for delivering advertising to consumers. Gosh, we're talking about the same people. Microsoft, same company that makes the operating system, is also vitally interested in that operating system making it possible for them to deliver consumers to advertisers.
All the better to serve you.
Exactly.
As we like to say. Well, now,
serve
is it safe
you up rare.
Is it safe to say that Google has more the consumer's interest in mind? For example, there's a couple of issues we haven't got to yet about Google. We're not going to stray there yet. Mm-hmm. But it strikes me that in a way, Google is in part on the side of the consumer in a way Microsoft isn't, or is that, am I being naive about that?
I think you are.
Okay.
They make it easier for consumers to see the kind of advertising that they may actually be interested in terms of products, but let's face it, there's nothing altruistic about it. It's all about the bottom line.
Well, that's true. It's a company after all, and that's the thing I think people mistake about corporations, whether it's the hundreds of corporations that are making billions of dollars from the extra money we're spending in Iraq, or it's corporations that want to serve you better. The bottom line is we shouldn't expect corporations to have a social conscience. Their job is to make money. And while they're made up of people, anybody who said, hey, we should and do anything but make more money would be should be fired because they're not looking out for the stockholders.
Exactly.
So that's the reason why.
The reason we have regulation.
Philosophically, that's why government regulation is necessary. You don't expect corporations to have a conscience and regulate themselves. If they can find a cheaper way to dump their waste, they'll do it. And they aren't going to say, you know what would be best for the public good? Some responsible people in positions will do that. But in general, that's not the model we should assume corporations are operating under.
Never assume that they're going to be good citizens. I can think of very few instances where a corporation...
You don't sound like a Republican, but you are.
I am dominantly left-handed, but not dominantly Republican.
Right, but you're a Southern Republican. Anyway, we don't need to get into the politics here because this is not about politics.
It's not about politics, not at all.
But back to the Do Not Track registry, this becomes difficult to implement because with Do Not Call, they just put your phone number on the Do Not Call list, and then a telemarketing company has to consult the Do Not Call list. They match their database numbers against the FTC's database, the Federal Trade Commission's database. And when they get a match and they say, don't call Andy Finn's number, they have to drop that from the predictive dialing database they have, which calls all these numbers.
Sure.
So that's a pretty clean and simple thing. And there'd be some glitches. It could take a few months for them to get your number. Your number might fall out of the database. You might have to re-sign up.
Mm-hmm.
A few little glitches.
Every 5 years, it turns out you do have to re-sign up.
Well, they're getting ready to rethink that. They're actually considering not requiring people to re-sign up.
Because it's just become clear that 5 years is up on the original enrollees in the list. And everybody's becoming aware all of a sudden that, what? This wasn't a lifetime deal. So naturally, there's some press about it.
And even the telemarketers know that there's no point in making people upset. They don't really want to call these people if they're going to be upset. So they may actually work with the FTC on this, is my understanding. I may be naive there, too.
Well, that's a point, but it's worth pointing out because that's not the way it works with web tracking. You know, if you're on a do not call list and you get called, well, you certainly know it. But if you're on a do not track list and you get tracked anyway, you don't know anything about it.
That's right. That's right. So let's talk about this issue of do not track and how that might work. So are they on their honor to not track you? Or you were saying that there has to be some changes in the software.
Yeah, it's a monumental compliance nightmare. See, there's no ready identifier of you at home with your computer. It used to be that, for instance, internet protocol addresses were hard-coded into your computer, so you always had the same IP address. But that's not the case anymore. Every time you log on to your provider, you're going to get a different IP address assigned to you dynamically.
That's right. These are dynamic IP addresses.
And there's certainly no way that they can track you via your email address because that's not even involved in your browsing.
Right.
So there's no way to identify people or specific people who do not want to be tracked. And so that means it has to be a blanket effort. And that means regulation and compliance oversight to ensure that companies are, that the people, for one thing, the people who make the server software and the people who make the browsers are just not including those components that allow it to be, to allow it to
happen. Right now the software is set up to do as much communication between providers and customers as possible and put the hooks in the software so you can easily track everything. And we'd have to change some of that, you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, the industry, especially the advertising industry, is saying, you know, it's hard, kind of a hard position to defend as far as I'm concerned, but they're saying, gee, there's a lot of consumers out there who would love to be tracked. They want to be tracked.
Yes.
I don't know that that's the case, but...
No, of course not.
But, and they also say there's all kinds of opt-in and opt-out options available for you. And of course, the best ones are the ones that are opt-in. In other words, if you wanted to be tracked, you'd have to tell them that you want to be tracked. Otherwise, you wouldn't be.
Yeah, let's walk back and talk about opt-in, opt-out for a minute. Because what you're talking about here is this, somehow the government, the FTC or the government, is suddenly taking the side of consumers. And the original opt-in, opt-out battle, as I recall, was this. Congress had a choice of passing a bill. This is about the privacy of your personal information. Let's say you subscribe to Newsweek magazine. Who owns your name and address? Do you own your name and address and they're not allowed to sell it to somebody else? Or do they own it? Or as part of their database, do they own all the names and addresses? And can they do anything they want with it? Well, in the general area of privacy, the original law that was passed about opt-in, opt-out was the consumer organization said, make it opt-in, that is, if people want their names and addresses and other information to be sold or given to other people to get helpful ads that we might like or other information, solicitations, you would have to opt-in and say, yes, I want that kind of information, versus opt-out, which says you get it, if you, they can do what they want with your name and address unless you opt-out. Well, as we know how this works, 99% of people are going to stick with whatever the default is. They're not going to sign the paperwork to either opt in or opt out. So the consumer groups had limited power and limited money, and the corporate groups and the advertisers and everybody else that wanted opt out to be the thing, yet as you have to explicitly say, I don't want you to do this to me. Those people had a lot of money. They lobbied Congress, son of a gun, if Congress didn't set it up as opt-outs. Consumers can opt out, they're free to, but we know 99% of people are going to end up in the situation where they haven't opted out.
Not only that, the web providers or the businesses that have websites very often make it extremely difficult to opt out. They may offer the service, but it'd be hard for you to find. You know, what page is it on? How small is the type? How's it done?
Right,
you know,
right.
All those kinds of things.
Yeah, they're very hard to find sometimes. Well, look, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to know what's changed. Why is it that the government, the FTC, is suddenly thinking of looking out for me? What has changed about that? We'll be back.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS radio network.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and John Clark, I want to talk to you, I want to ask you about this issue. Mm-hmm. What has changed when it comes to this either opt-in, opt-out, or why is it the government is now thinking of looking out for consumers with a do-not-track list on the Internet?
I'm not so sure that it's fair to say that the government is really interested in looking into this and doing anything about it, but what's changed is the overall level of awareness on the part of consumer groups and privacy advocates, some very powerful and some organized groups in increasing numbers who are aware of the dangers of this, all this data collection and all that kind of thing, and so have mounted some pretty intense lobbying efforts And so they are making such a noise about it that the government has agreed to hold hearings over a two-day period to look at the issue. There's absolutely no promise of action whatsoever. And not only that, the government organizations, FTC, but primarily FTC, are saying that any changes that that are going to be made are going to be have to be enacted by the legislature. That's a completely different ball of wax, because we know where members of Congress get their money. It's from businesses a lot of times.
Right.
And corporate America. And, of course, those people respond to lobbyists. So you've got lobbying on both sides, and we'll just have to see who's got the stronger arms and the deeper purses when it comes to getting this kind of legislation enacted. But I think it's still beneficial for society and for individuals for this issue to come up, get some press, get some hearings, you know, bring it out in the open, and hopefully educate some more people about what's going on and the kind of information that's been gathered about them.
Right, and let's remember, folks, that somehow the Do Not Call list got past the lobbying and the people, the telemarketers. And the telemarketers are not this small group of people who, you know, prey on consumers. It's a wide swath of companies that do telemarketing. And yet, the law got passed and the FTC then enforced this Do Not Call list. And it's been wildly successful. And Congress knows that people love it.
Well, and the reason it got passed was because there was such a groundswell of public opinion against it. I remember very well the Do Not Call list in Kentucky predates the federal Do Not Call list, and there were a number of other states that already had Do Not Call lists, and when the federal list went into effect, all the other states' lists were subsumed into the federal list. But the Attorney General in Kentucky at the time, Ben Chandler, I would vote for him in any... He's a Democrat, by the way. I would vote for him in any race that he ever ran, because he was responsible for getting the Do Not Call list passed in Kentucky. And I remember the summer it went into effect. It went into effect in July. And at that point, I was receiving anywhere from 12 to 15 to 18 telemarketing calls every single day. And of course, as an academic, I was home during the summer, you know, with my daughter. And, it was absolutely ridiculous, and it was so annoying, and the telemarketers were, you know, it was the heyday of the telemarketers, and they were abusing their privileges to such a degree that it just made everybody mad. And when you get that many people mad, when you're using everybody's phones, you know how ubiquitous phones are, everybody's got one. And so when you get that many people who are getting 15 telemarketing calls a day, then those people are getting sore enough to make it tough on their own representatives from their districts.
Yeah, you know? So let's wrap up this segment by talking about one other thing that upsets people, and that is the level of spam in our email. Okay, so there should be a Do Not Spam list too, or spam is illegal, I guess, but the point is we can't seem to stop them because there's so many ways you can fool the internet and fool the system. They can't track you down. They use phony, phantom addresses and all of this. Mm-hmm. But it is unbelievable. And just so people out there, if you haven't, you're aware how much spam you're getting, depending on your account, how long you've had it, and how many people have learned about it. But George Mason's email, I get email on three or four different systems that I use, but my George Mason email every day delivers me a message that says the following messages have been filtered out as spam. We didn't deliver to your mailbox. If you want any of them, click on them and we'll give them to you. And they're all spam. They don't take a message away from me very often, mm-hmm. that they shouldn't. But they at the top they list the total in the last 24 hours the total number of messages that came into the servers and the percentage that were legitimate messages, not spam. And it has gotten ridiculous. Now, about 5-8 years ago, we used to say 25% of the messages were spam. Then it got to 50%. Then it was 70% maybe 4 years ago. 95% of the messages that come into George Mason, and that is an academic address, right? It's .edu. Mm-hmm. You would think that'd be less commercial messages than Gmail or MSN addresses. Mm-hmm. But 95% is now spam. That is unsolicited commercial messages. that people don't haven't asked for and mostly don't want, but since it's free to send them, the system is inundated with spam. How do we stop that?
To tell the truth, I don't think we can stop it. .edu domain names are especially vulnerable because the software that spammers use, it has an easy time finding lots of viable email addresses at institutions of higher learning because they're all over professors' web pages. They're included in any number of lists that are on websites. And the people who collect, of course, what they really want are legitimate email addresses. But the fact is they make them all up. And if you go to a place like George Mason or the University of Kentucky, and you know you've got 15,000 employees and 26,000 students, for instance, at UK, then all you do is tack on a uky.edu ending to any permutation of any number of names, and you're bound to get lots of hits that work.
Right.
So educational institutions are particularly vulnerable to that kind of thing.
But we haven't been able to stop it yet, and we're not going to go into detail to why that is. But spammers send millions, billions of messages a day because it's free. And see, if they have to send you stuff, junk mail through the post office, junk mail, you need a hit rate, let's say, of at least 1% to make it worth your while. That is, 1 out of 100 people have to buy something from you to make it worthwhile to keep going because it costs you postage. But emails are essentially free. So if they send out 1 million messages and they only get one person to buy, that's okay. They'll send out 100 million messages and then 100 people buy that day. They could send out 1 billion messages. They don't care as long as they can find the legitimate addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's why the only advice we can give you about spam is that if you're dealing with a legitimate company, like you've signed up for something, a list, or messages, commercial messages, you know, said, tell me about your new offers with the company you do business with, the bank, or, you know, if you bought software from them, and you don't want it anymore, it's okay to click at the bottom where it says, you know, let it unsubscribe and we'll unsubscribe you. The legitimate companies do unsubscribe you, but if you get messages that are unsolicited and they are not anybody you do business with, unsubscribing is a bad idea because what you're doing when you go out and say, I want to unsubscribe, is you're confirming to them you have reached a legitimate address.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So it's tricky, but never unsubscribe from somebody that you think is junk mail, that they had no way of knowing who you are, because they're not sure you're out there getting this message. They're hoping.
Yeah, and it's increasingly difficult to tell, too, because of the phishing scam that goes on. They all these phishing scams look so legitimate. The emails you get have legitimate banking logos and all the proper information at the bottom and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so make sure that people know what the phishing is. P-H-I-S-H refers to you get a message from the Bank of America or from some bank. Now, you may not even have an account there, but what it says is, we need you, we've had a problem with our computers or with crime, online crime. We want you to log into your account and give us your, you know, and change your ID and password or verify your information. And they send you to a website that looks a great deal like Bank of America's website, but it's not. It's a fake website at a fake URL. You'll notice it is not www.bankofamerica.com. It's something else if you look close. And then when you type in your ID and password, they have access to your account.
Well, very often it is www.bankofamerica.com, and that's what it looks like to you. It's just that when you click on it, that's not the address that it sent you.
Right, that's what I mean. You have to look and see where it sends you.
Yeah, but that's one of the things that I love about Mozilla Firefox. That software includes a couple of great safety features. One of them is It prevents pop-up windows from occurring unless you allow them to happen.
Right.
And very often the pop-ups are the ones that are associated with backdoors into your computer and download spyware and that kind of thing. But the other thing it does is it maintains a database of every URL that's already been identified as a suspicious URL engaged in fraudulent activity. And when you're using Firefox, you can get one of those phishing scam emails, click on it, and see what happens. It'll say, do you really want to do this? It's got a button underneath that says, get me out of here.
Right, right. Well, and I use a desktop email client, as you know. I use Eudora. Most people don't use Eudora, but there are other desktop emails. And what desktop email does is, as opposed to going out to a website to get your email, you have your email provider download it to your computer, so it's sitting on your desktop. It doesn't take as long to go through it or to open attachments. Now, not every provider allows you to do this. The free services like MSN and that, I don't think you can set it up to download some of those. And I could be wrong about that. But I download all my messages from three or four different accounts to my desktop. It all appears in my Eudora interface. And when I roll over one of those URLs that are phony, before I click on it, as I roll over it, it says, warning, you are about to be redirected to a website that is different than the URL they're showing you.
Right.
So there are a couple of ways in which you can get those warnings. But
I recently had to give up Eudora because the university quit supporting it, and so reluctantly I moved to Entourage, which is a Microsoft product. Entourage is Outlook for Macs. And even though it's got its problems and things that aren't exactly easy to figure out, I've got to give it really high marks for identifying spam and security problems. But one of the reasons it works so well is because, of course, it's running on a Mac.
Oh, stop it. We have this back and forth on with Macs and Windows, and John loves his Mac, and I don't like defending Windows, but that is...
Because it's impossible.
But that is 90% of the universe, so I prefer being with the winners, you know, John? Anyway, let's take a short break, and when we come back... We got a couple of other technology issues we can address if we decide that's the direction we're going to go.
Okay.
We could end up talking about music. Who knows?
Who indeed?
The Andy Finn Show can be accessed at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. And we'll be back live after this.